Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City, and I welcome you. We're going to be exploring nearly 100% of conventionally raised chickens. That's what you're eating out there. Are contaminated with cancer-causing arsenic, and how keeping your gut bacteria in balance can help delay age-related diseases. That's from UCLA. We're also going to talk about the Mediterranean diet, plus olive oil is associated with a reduced breast cancer risk from University of Navarra in Spain, and how, I've said it a long time, an onion a day keeps a stroke away. Well, from the University of Bonn in Germany, onion extracts lower blood pressure for hypertensives. Right about that, so think of all of you who've been using that onion a day and have not had a stroke because of it. Too much, too late. Doctors should cut back on some medicines in seniors, so says the University of Michigan Health System, plus a lot more on health. Then I'm going to take on the issue of why global warming. Patricia, exactly the kind of terrifying storm to expect. We're going to have a lot more of that, and I'll explain why. Then, from a person I have a lot of respect for, John Pilger, Tony Blair must be arrested under the Proceeds of Crime Act. This is in the New Statesman. Also, for those who believe that, including programs on Pacifica, I'm sorry to say, and advocated for the disposition of Gaddafi, that it was a good thing? No, it wasn't. Not by any measure. But I want to be really specific. I'm going to give you 10 things that Gaddafi did that you don't know about, and that the people who caused his overthrow and the destruction of his country did know about. And why didn't the media pick up on this? Also today, I'll continue with part two of a very important commentary that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, writing about, and giving insights, and also those of Professor Henri Giroux. I'm going to set time aside also for some audio clips, including Dr. Thompson of the CDC, on mercury in vaccines, in those vaccines that are advocated by the CDC, the institution he works for, being given to pregnant women. Now, you would think that since he's a leading scientist, he is one of their experts on mercury in vaccines, that the CDC would not be advocating. No, they are. But here's what he had to say when he did not know he was being recorded. Also, the Indian government files biopiracy laws against Monsanto. And I don't know if we'll have time for this. If not today, then on our next program. There's a lot of bioengineering of weapon systems, especially weather systems. But this is not new. It went clear back to Vietnam and before. I found an interesting clip about Operation Popeye. Never heard of it? If we can play it, we will. So let's begin. We have a lot to share. A lot of people like chicken, and it's something that we're taught to enjoy in all of its different forms. And when I'm watching a commercial, I see it a little differently. I see what is actually in the food. I know how the food is prepared. I know how the animals are raised. I just finished a major documentary on this that is being released nationwide and worldwide in another 2 months. And so I'm not seeing it as something that will satisfy your appetite. I'm seeing it as something that will cause disease. This is the latest from Natural Health and also published in the Environmental Health Perspectives. Quote, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, issued a report denouncing an arsenic drug being used in conventional poultry and pigs, that drug called 3-nitro or roxazerone are known carcinogen to humans, used to treat poultry feed, which in turn treats intestinal parasites in chickens and gives them an appealing pink color. An estimated 80% of about 9 billion chickens raised for human consumption in the United States were treated with 3-nitro. In response to the FDA's report, the producers of 3-nitro, which is a subsidiary of Pfizer company, voluntarily began the suspension process for its sales. Their final withdrawal took 3 years and just ended recently when the FDA formally withdrew the drug's approval. Even though conventional chicken is no longer threatened by that, the arsenic scare isn't over. A new study published in Environmental Health Perspectives indicates that inorganic arsenic is still a threat to conventional chickens in the United States. More dangerous than 3-nitro, inorganic arsenic accumulates in the meat of treated chickens. Cramped and filthy, it's no wonder that today's modern chicken production facilities need to treat their chickens to to the fact of parasites, and also to cause them to grow faster. Unfortunately, most of your factory farm chickens, that's the kind that you're going to find in almost all the television commercials and sold in all your fast food places and in restaurants, are intentionally contaminated with inorganic arsenic. According to the Environmental Health Perspective study, analysis showed that conventional chickens contain high amounts of inorganic arsenic, and mega samples were taken from 3 categories of chickens: conventional chickens, which arsenic drugs are used; conventional antibiotic-free chickens, in which arsenic drugs were unlikely but possibly used; and certified organic chickens, in which arsenic feed was not used. The results were clear that inorganic arsenic was highest in cooked conventional chicken meat and lowest in certified organic chicken meat. The difference is astounding. Now, why should you be interested? Because, according to several studies, there's devastating health consequences as a result of eating any animal that has arsenic in it. And arsenic toxicity is species-dependent, and it's well-established. It can cause type 2 diabetes, cancer. Additionally, the United States Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry and the Environmental Health and Medicine Education reports that arsenic toxicity affects your gastrointestinal system, your liver, your kidneys, your heart, your entire central nervous system, your skin, your lungs, your blood, and reproductive organs. So, the answer, simply, don't eat chickens, organic or not, because even in the organic, you can still get traces. We know, you know, how important good probiotics are. We know that when we eat sauerkraut or kefirs or non-dairy alternatives, like non-dairy, like coconut yogurt or rice stream yogurt, you're getting probiotics. Or if you just take probiotics, they rebuild good bacteria in your gut, and that helps maintain overall good health, and that's what we want. This is from the University of California, published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell Reports. Quote, "Why do some people remain healthy into their 80s and beyond, while others age faster and suffer serious diseases decades earlier? New research led by UCLA life scientists may produce a new way to answer that question, and an approach that could help delay declines in health. Specifically, the study suggests that analyzing intestinal bacteria could be a promising way to predict health outcomes as we age. The researchers discovered changes within intestinal microbes that precede and predict the death of fruit flies. Quote, age-onset decline is very tightly linked to changes within the community of gut microbes. With age, the number of bacterial cells increase substantially, and the composition of the bacteria cells change." Okay, so what's this mean to you and I in just lay language? It means this. When you have sugar, you produce an acceleration of bad bacteria. When you have alcohol, bad bacteria. Artificial flavors, coloring agents, bad bacteria. Fried food, animal proteins, bad bacteria. A lot of the highly processed oils, including the trans fats, like when you eat French fries, the oil has been heated at a very high temperature. Its chemical consistencies change throughout the day, and it's very similar to varnish. And the body has a real hard time digesting it. And that's why a lot of people have indigestion and bloating after consuming a normal fast food meal. But it also contributes to bad bacteria. Stress, bad bacteria. Now, when you're eating healthy and you're taking lots of fiber foods and nuts and seeds, legumes, good bacteria. When you're having fermented foods, good bacteria. So the fruits, the vegetables, the juices, the grains, good bacteria. It's that simple. So the more good bacteria, the longer your body stays healthy. And the more bad bacteria, the quicker you die. It's that simple. Now, adding to the good news, this is published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine, done at the University of Navarra in Spain. I'll quote them, "Eating a Mediterranean diet, supplemented with extra virgin olive oil, was associated with a relatively lower risk of breast cancer in a study in women." And, well, we know that breast cancer is frequently diagnosed cancer and a leading cause of death in women. And diet has been extensively studied as a modifiable risk factor in the development of breast cancer. So this just goes one more step of showing that you need that. You need, they say, quote, mixed nuts, 30 grams a day. They want you to have hazelnuts. They want you to have almonds, 7.5 and 7.5 grams. That's not even an ounce. That's a small amount of nuts. But if you want to prevent breast cancer, just a small amount of nuts each day can help you. And seeds also, sunflower seeds, chia seeds, are also good. So, in eating lots of fruits and vegetables. So this study shows, for all the women in this audience, and they study 4,281 women over a six-year period, that either the women got a Mediterranean diet with nuts, or they got a Mediterranean diet without nuts, and those that got the nuts, a big benefit. It helped prevent breast cancer. And that's good news. Also, an onion a day keeps a stroke away. We have all heard an apple a day keeps a doctor away, and that's, well, that can be true. Again, you have to put everything into a proper, larger context. If you ate all junk foods and then had an onion, it's not going to make a difference. If you ate all junk foods and had an apple, it's not going to make a difference. But if you're eating healthy and you're living healthy, then the addition of apple to your diet, either as apples, apple skin in a blender, apple juice, apple sauce, always good. If you're eating well and you add then my idea, which is a half of a raw onion. Now, there's a lot of ways of eating the onion. One of the best ways is simply to cut it very thin, a sweet onion. You rinse it under water for about 10 seconds. And that gets rid of the bitters. Then sprinkle lemon juice on it and some Himalayan sea salt and cayenne pepper. And then put that onto a tomato, a sliced tomato. And then put a piece of avocado on top of that. And then baste some horseradish mustard on that. And that's a great snack. It gives you proteins, essential fatty acids, polyphenols, quercetin, antioxidants, good fibers. And it lowers your blood pressure. Just that alone will be in your body circulating for about 5 hours. So if you can't take an onion, then get yourself some onion concentrate, like in a capsule. That would be next best, but I prefer people get their onions and also get raw and get make some brown rice and then dice up some sweet onions and mix it in. Because it then changes the mouthfeel, and that's also good. And then dice it up, put it into a baked potato with some shiitake mushrooms. That's also another good way. Here's what it says. It's the University of Bonn in Germany, published in the British Journal of Nutrition. Quote, taking onion skin derivative food supplements of a flavanol quercetin can lower blood pressure of people with hypertension. This is what they did in this double-blind study of people who are overweight or obese who had hypertension or pre-hypertension. And it didn't take a lot. So I suggest if you remember, they're also saying that inside of that onion is quercetin. Yeah. And quercetin also can be found in kale, apple skins, all your berries, and grapefruit, lemons, and limes, and green tea. So it's the flavonoids that are really doing it, and quercetin in particular is the best single antioxidant for cardiovascular health. It'll help protect your heart from if you have any form of tachycardia or irregular heartbeat, if you have congestive heart failure, if you have arterial sclerosis, atherosclerosis, it will help you and as a part of an overall healthier program. But if you have particularly high blood pressure, it helps lower it. And an onion is one of your two best sources of quercetin. So that's important. And finally, too much, too late. This is from University of Michigan Health System. And here's what they say. Anyone who takes medicine to get their blood sugar and blood pressure down, or both, knows their doctors prescribe it to help them. But what if stopping, or at least cutting back on such drugs, could help even more? In some older people, that may be the safer route. And two new studies published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine suggest doctors and patients should work together to backpedal such treatments more often. And it's just simply saying older people are given way too many medications when there are serious side effects of these medications, and lifestyle modification can do the same thing without all the medicines. Now, let me give you just an example. I will be submitting for publication next week to major scientific and medical journals, peer-reviewed journals, a major study that I completed in the last 12 months. Many of you in this audience were in it. And in this study, we were able to lower blood sugar and blood pressure, statistically significant numbers, more than any other study we could find. Because one of the things you do when you're doing a study is when you finish the study, you have to see whether or not you really did anything that can be supported by other studies, or is it unique? So when we came up with our results of a lifestyle and behavior modification program, over a 90-day period, three-month period, we then had to look at the entire scientific literature of people who've used lifestyle and behavior modification. What results did they get? Not a single study could we find, not one. And I had to list all the studies, dozens of studies in every category. And then you have to go further. Let's say that one of the protocols, I gave them vitamin D, and I gave them B-complex and vitamin C and quercetin and vitamin E, coenzyme Q10, so many servings of grains, so many servings of vegetables. For every single one of those things in the protocol, I have to list all the supporting scientific literature to show that there's a scientific basis to it. So it took us 3 months after the study to finish up all the scientific work, and that's one of the reasons that the studies are frequently accepted, and because they meet all the standards of good quality science. And we're done with everything. And we showed that there's never been a study published that has gotten people's blood pressure down and their blood sugar down in such a large percentage of the participants in such a short period of time. So that's good. My hope is it'll be published, and I'll probably present it before some scientific group in the next 12 months. I do this once or twice a year with different studies. I'll be starting another study in about 3 months. In any case, what I found was that why should all these people be taking medications that have only serious side effects? renal failure, liver failure, impotency, immune dysfunction, causing all forms of skin conditions, hair to fall out. That's the traditional approach. And yet, medicine is not looking at, can we help these people with something that is less aggressive and toxic to the body? Because the entire medical model is based upon a pharmacological approach, because behind that are the pharmaceutical drug makers pushing their drugs. So lifestyle counts, and it can be very, very positive. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. We have a lot of program coming up, and time permitting, I'll be opening up the lines to get your feedback on the commentaries that are coming. From the environment, this is from Common Dreams. Hurricane Patricia, which was just last week, by the way, the most intense hurricane ever recorded in the Western Hemisphere, was downgraded to a tropical depression with 35 mile an hour sustaining winds on Saturday, and offered some observers a reminder of the consequences of warming the planet. No fatalities from the historic storm, which forced the evacuation of 50,000 people, have yet to be reported, and the initial reporting indicates no major devastation. Damages from potential heavy rains and winds and landslides are still unfolding as the storm makes its way inland. And it went on to talk about that this is the new norm, that we can expect this. And it went from a tropical storm to more than 220 mile an hour winds and a category 5 plus in just less than 24 hours. That's never happened before. Generally, it takes a longer period of time. Now, imagine this. Imagine what would happen if that was a storm like Sandy that was only category 1. But what if it went from category 1 to a category 5? And what if it came in anywhere where Sandy did? You would see devastation into the hundreds of billions of dollars, tens of thousands of lives adversely affected, and thousands of deaths. That's what's possible, but that's the new norm. And it's not the storm always in and of itself. Now we have to be aware that at nighttime, because of the rise in sea levels, the currents are bringing the tides in further and further inland, much further than before. And so whole areas are now going to be inundated. And then what happens is, if it's porous soil, though, a lot of that water is not going to go back out into the ocean. It's just going to go right down into the aquifers. And the water, whether it's an encapsulated water, Jurassic water, whatever the source of water, it's going to go into that underneath the soil. And that is going to be salty water, and that's going to pollute it. So we have a lot to be paying attention to do, and therefore we should be doing everything we can to get off fossil fuels as quickly as possible and get on what's out there. And geothermal, it's inexpensive. We have a lot of geothermal. Wave power that could be used around the entire United States. Inexpensive. The technology is there. I know that some people believed that getting rid of Gaddafi was a good thing. Liberating the people of Libya was a good thing. Stopping the slaughter of Libyans was a good thing. The trouble is, it was not. Here's what you have not been told. These are facts. One, in Libya, home is considered, was, a natural human right. In Gaddafi's Green Book, it states, quote, "The house is a basic need of both the individual and the family. Therefore, it should not be owned by others." Now, Gaddafi's Green Book is the formal leader's political philosophy. It was published in 1975, and Libyans then believed that their home was their home, and it was. And there was every effort made by the Libyan government to see the people own their own homes. Number two, education and medical treatment both were free to everyone. So under Gaddafi, Libya could boast one of the best health care services in the Middle East, and certainly the best in all of Africa. Also, if a Libyan citizen could not access desired education in the course that they wanted, or correct medical treatment in Libya, they were funded, their travel, the treatment, no matter what it cost, anywhere else in the world. Number three, Gaddafi carried out the world's largest irrigation project. Mind you, the largest irrigation system in the world was also known as the Great Man-Made River, and it was designed to make water readily available to all Libyans across the entire country. It was funded by the Gaddafi government, and it was considered an engineering marvel, and that was to help everyone everywhere in Libya. Four, it was free. Any Libyan was free to start a farming business. In fact, not only did the Libyan government want you to start a farming business, they would purchase you a home, farmland, livestock, and all the seeds free if you wanted to be a farmer. Five, a bursary was given to mothers with newborn babies. Every woman in Libya was given $5,000 for herself and her child when she had a child. All electricity, number six, was free. Electricity was free in Libya, meaning absolutely no electric bills. Water, no water bills. And the cheapest petrol that you could find. How much was it? 14 cents a liter. Number eight, Gaddafi raised the level of education. Before Gaddafi, only 25% of Libyans were literate. He brought it up to 87%. With 25% of all Libyans earning university degrees. No other country in Africa or the Middle East could brag of that, at least in Africa. Nine, Libya had its own state bank, and which provided loans to citizens at zero interest by law, and they had no external debt. Ten, and this is where he got himself into trouble, the gold dinar. Before the fall of Tripoli and his untimely demise, Gaddafi was trying to introduce a single African currency linked to gold. And he had over 124,000 tons of gold. That's a huge amount. No, excuse me, 124 tons of gold, not 1,000 of gold. And following in the footsteps of the late pioneer Marcus Garvey, who first coined the term United States of Africa, Gaddafi wanted to introduce and only trade in the African gold dinar, a move which would have thrown the world economy into chaos. And the dinar was widely opposed by the elite, the oligarchy of our society today, and the African nations would have finally had the power to bring itself out of debt and poverty and only trade in this precious commodity. They would have been able to finally say no to the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and outside exploitation, and would have been able to charge suitable fees for precious resources. And it has been said that the gold dinar was the real reason for the NATO-led rebellion in a bid to oust the outspoken leader. So then the question is, why? Well, we were told that it was because he was killing his own people. What you were not told was that the CIA and other governments, including the British government and the French government, they had mercenaries in there. They were paying terrorists to attack Libyans, and they were behind a lot of this. And as a result, we only heard one side of the issue. So now ask yourself, what would Libya be like today? It was the most successful and the most solvent city in Africa, or state in Africa. Now look at it. It is a completely failed state, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people from Libya are now the refugees trying to find hope in Italy, in Germany, in Greece. And it's also a breeding ground and a training area for terrorists, including Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, ISIS. So what exactly did we gain by destroying it, as we're doing the same identical blueprint in Syria and as we did with Iraq? Exactly what did we create that makes it a safer world for the United States and the citizens of the nations that we've invaded? Following up on that, I'll quote from John Pilger, an article as published in the New Statesman. Quote, Tony Blair must be prosecuted, not indulged like Peter Mandelson. Both have produced self-serving memoirs for which they have been paid fortunes. Blair's has earned him $4.6 million, not million dollars, that would be million euros, but $6 million he's made. Now consider the Proceeds of Crime Act. Blair conspired in and executed an unprovoked war of aggression against a defenseless nation of a kind the Nuremberg judges in 1946 described as the paramount war crime. This has caused, according to scholarly studies, the deaths of more than a million people, a figure that exceeds the Fordham University estimate of deaths in the Rwanda genocide. In addition, 4 million Iraqis have been forced to flee their homes, and a majority of children have descended into malnutrition and trauma. Cancer rates near the cities of Fallujah and Basra, later liberated by the British, are now higher than those at Hiroshima. Quote, UK forces used about 1.9 metric tons of depleted uranium ammunition in the war in 2003. The Defense Secretary Liam Fox told Parliament on July 22nd, a toxic range of, quote, anti-personal weapons such as cluster bombs was employed by British and U.S. forces. Such carnage was justified with lies that had been exposed repeatedly. On the 29th of January 2003, Blair told Parliament, quote, we do know of links between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, end quote. Last month, the former head of M15, Elisa Manningham Buller, told Chilcot Inquiry, quote, there is no credible intelligence to suggest that connection. It was the invasion that gave Osama bin Laden his Iraqi jihad, end quote. Asked to what extent the invasion exacerbated the threat to Britain from terrorism, she replied, quote, substantially. The bombings in London on 7th of July 2005 were a direct consequence of Tony Blair's decision to invade and support the invasion of Iraq. But it's all based upon voracious greed. Documents released by the High Court show that British citizens were allowed to be abducted and tortured under Blair. In January 2002, Jack Straw, then Foreign Secretary, decided that Guantanamo was, quote, the best way to ensure that UK nationals were securely held. Instead of remorse, Tony Blair has demonstrated a voracious and secretive greed. Since stepping down as Prime Minister in 2007, he has accumulated an estimated £20 million. Much of it is a result of the ties he developed with the Bush administration, the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments, which vets jobs taken by former ministers, was pressured not to make public Blair's consultancy deals with the Kuwaiti royal family and the South Korean oil giant UI Energy Corporation. He gets an estimated $2 million a year, £2 million a year, for supposedly advising the investment bank JP Morgan, Chase, and undisclosed sums from other financial service companies. He makes millions from speeches. In his unpaid but expense-rich role as peace envoy to the Middle East, Blair is in effect a voice of Israel, which has awarded him $1 million peace prize. In other words, his wealth has grown rapidly since he launched, with George W. Bush, the bloodbath in Iraq. His collaborators are numerous. The cabinet in March 2003 knew a great deal about the conspiracy to attack Iraq. Strahl, later appointed Justice Secretary, suppressed the relevant cabinet minutes in defiance of an order by the Information Commissioner to release them. Most of those now running for the Labour Party leadership supported Blair's epic crime, rising as one to salute his final appearance in the Commons. As Foreign Secretary David Miliband sought to cover up Britain's complicity in torture, he promoted Iran as the next threat. Journalists who once fawned on Blair as mystical and amplified his vainglorious bids now pretend they were his critics all along. As for the media's gulling of the public, only The Observer's David Rose has apologized. The WikiLeaks expose, released with a moral objective of truth with justice, have been bracing for a public force-fed on complicit lobbying journalism. Verbose celebrity historians such as Niall Ferguson, who rejoiced in Blair's rejuvenation of enlightened imperialism, remain silent about the moral truancy. It is wishful thinking that Tony Blair will be colored, arrested, just as the Cameron government understands the threat of a law that makes Britain a risky stopover for Israeli war criminals. Blair faces a similar risk in a number of countries and jurisdictions, at least of being apprehended and questioned. He is now Britain's Henry Kissinger, who plans his travel outside the United States with care of a fugitive. Two recent events add weight to this. On June 15th, the International Criminal Court made the landmark decision to add aggression to its list of war crimes that can be prosecuted. It defines this as a, quote, crime committed by a political or military leader which by his character, gravity, and scale constituted a manifest violation of the United Nations Charter, end quote. International lawyers describe this as a giant leap. Britain is a signatory to the Rome Statute that created the court and is bound by its decisions. On July 21st, Nick Clegg, standing at the Commons dispatch box, declared the invasion of Iraq illegal. For all the letter clarification that he was speaking personally, the Deputy Prime Minister had made, quote, a statement that the International Court would be interested in. Philippe Sands, Professor of International Law, University of College, London. Blair came from Britain's upper middle classes, which have rejoiced in his ascendancy, might now reflect on the principles of right and wrong. They require their own children. The suffering of the children of Iraq will remain a specter haunting Britain while Blair remains free to profit. End quote. So, Tony Blair, because Britain signed on to that provision, you will, in time, make a mistake, and you will be arrested. The unfortunate part is that the people who created this crime, the neocons, both conservative and liberal, corporate interest in this country, they will not be arrested. They were not signatories to this, though they are signatories to the Nuremberg laws, and there are a lot of other ways that they can be held accountable, but we do not have the political will to hold anybody accountable for anything when they're that powerful. That's unfortunate. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Looking forward to sharing some really interesting insights with people coming to the lecture tonight. Sorry, we have no more room, but I am filming it, and you'll see the results in about 3 months when I finish the documentary on it. We are still looking for some people who have a car or van who can help. We have a lot of equipment to move over for the filming. Now, yesterday I gave part one of a commentary based upon what's happening with our youth. And I used the example of the young teenager who was pulled by her hair and thrown down on the ground and arrested in a high school. And because she had her cell phone on, by the time she turned her cell phone off and put it away, the teacher who was angry at this because she didn't do it when she was asked to. And then in come the police, and this guy really smacked her down, and he was fired. And I suggested that before we react on any level, let us put this in perspective. On the one hand, and we must be cognitive of this, it's really challenging being a teacher. Because as a teacher, there was a time, until fairly recently, when you would honor the ideal of helping the people sitting across from you in class to become critical thinkers, develop the kind of skills and insights and knowledge that would be able to be applied to life sciences in a way that would allow them to succeed in life. It was not your responsibility to teach them character or manners or morals or ethics. That was the responsibility of the parents and grandparents and those who were in attendance to this person's evolution. If there was a problem, you would generally take it up with the student, and if you couldn't, you had the principal take it up or an administrator. But in 99% of the cases, it was dealt with, and the person learned some lesson. Generally, the worst that would happen when I was growing up is you would have to stay late, or you would have to do some form of work around the school. There was no physical violence, but you didn't want to shame yourself nor your family by acting out in such a way that your reputation was adversely affected. Today, being a teacher is not easy because many teachers are challenged by students who are not there to learn, and the teacher cannot compete with the environment that child is exposed to outside the class and frequently in the class. And as a result, many teachers do the best they can in providing the class, but even the curriculum is meant to help students pass tests today rather than critical thinking. So in effect, for many students, not all, but for many students, we are passing functionally illiterate students. But then it's very easy, and there's a knee-jerk reaction for people to blame the parents. And as I said yesterday, before you blame anyone, shouldn't you take a look at the environment in which those parents are living, the children are living, and if they're a person from a minority background, the entire group is living? And I gave an example of a once prosperous city that had almost no crime to speak of and almost no murders, and that was Detroit. And also I gave Camden, New Jersey as two examples. But when the jobs were outsourced, with the idea of making more profit for those who are capable of outsourcing them, no one thought about what does it mean to be left behind. And as a result, in dire poverty, crime almost always ensues. And the breakup of families, alcoholism, drugs, and crime. Not everyone, however, succumbs to the lowest elements within an environment. Many people, because of their own upbringing and their own moral and character, manage to maintain their principles even when faced with multiple obstacles. So now imagine being a mother, a single mother, or a married mother, and you do the best you can to teach your kid the importance of going to school, the importance of behavior, and now that kid goes outside and enters a different world, the peers and the media. And the parent has a hard time maintaining any control over that. Some will succeed, the vast majority will not. And then we see it's not just a bad kid. There are a lot of bad kids. And they influence each other. They work off each other. And unfortunately, then the parent is blamed. What if the parent has done the best they can, but the culture, the environment that kid is in is also manifesting, and then the kid doesn't make the right choices. At some point, we also have to give credit to the kid who decides to be a punk or to act out, or like the student who took a pencil yesterday, sharpened it, and started stabbing the teacher. Why? Because the kid was acting out in class, and before that had been suspended and was back in class. Well, would you imagine the parent would have said, if a teacher says anything you don't like, stab him with a pencil? I doubt it. Yeah, we've got some bad parents, but they're not the majority. We've got some bad kids. They're not yet the majority. But if we don't understand what's happening in the larger context, if we don't pull ourselves back enough to get an objective view, then we've lost an entire generation with only probably 5% surviving and thriving in the way that they were meant to, that we did. And hence, today, I'm going to share some thoughts about the war on youth. And Henry Giroux says it best when he talks about the war on youth is spreading. Yeah, it is. How else can you explain the United States turning of schools into training centers and modeling after prisons, or promoting the rise of power of repression, such as teaching to the test and high-stakes testing, all in the name of educational reform? Well, that's bunk. What is the role of education in a democracy when a society burdens an entire generation with high tuition costs and student loans? I think David Graeber is right in arguing when he says student loans are destroying the imagination of youth. If there's a way of a society committing mass suicide, what better way than to take all the youngest and most energetic and creative and joyous young people in your society and saddle them with like $50,000 of debt so they have to be slaves? Well, there goes your music. There goes your culture. There goes your ballet. There goes your symphony. There goes your history. There goes your philosophy. There goes your ethics classes. There goes the student. We're a society that has lost our ability to incorporate the interesting, creative, and eccentric people. What he does not say is that many young people are also being depoliticized because they are struggling just to survive, not only materially, but also existentially. What do I mean? Under such circumstances, all bets are off regarding the future of democracy. What is also being lost in the current historical conjuncture is the very idea of interpersonal responsibility, a commitment to the collective good, a democratic notion of the commons, the idea of connecting learning to social improvement, and the promise of a robust democracy dedicated to a full measure of personal, political, and economic rights. Under the regime of a ruthless economic Darwinism, we are witnessing the crumbling of social bonds and the triumph of individual desires over social rights, nowhere more exemplified than in the growth of civic illiteracy, gated minds and gated communities, simplistic intolerance, atrophied social skills, and a culture of cruelty and a downward spiral into the dark recesses of an oligarchical social order. Children pay most acutely for this. Consider that the United States is the only country in the world, the only country on the planet that refused to ratify the UN Convention on the Rights of Children, which calls for a commitment to promote and respect the human rights of children, including the right to life, to health, to education, and to play, as well as the right to family life, to be protected from violence and from any form of discrimination. Yet that wasn't good enough for us. Politics is now driven by much promoted hyper-competitive ideology with a message that surviving in society demands reducing social relations to forms of social combat. Too many young people today learn quickly that their fate is solely a matter of individual responsibility, irrespective of wider structural forces. As such, politics has become an extension of war, just as systemic economic insecurity and anxiety and the state sponsor of violence increasingly find the legitimizing in the discourses of austerity, privatization, and demonization, which promote anxiety, moral panics, and fear, and undermine any sense of communal responsibility for the well-being of others. The curse of privatization in a consumer-driven society is intensified by the market-driven assumption that for young people, the only obligation of citizenship is to consume. Yet there is more at work here than the mechanisms of depoliticization. There is also the flight from social responsibility, if not politics itself. And also lost is the importance of those social bonds, the modes of collective reasoning, public spheres, and cultural apparatuses crucial to the formation of a sustainable democratic society. As one eminent sociologist points out, visions have nowadays fallen into disrepute, and we tend to be proud of what we should be ashamed of. For instance, politicians such as former Vice President Dick Cheney not only refuse to apologize for the immense misery and displacement and suffering they have imposed on the Iraqi people, principally Iraqi children, but also remember it was Hillary and Bill Clinton, who decided to sacrifice 500,000 children, let them die, because the sanctions are worth it. No, they were not. And that's who you're going to vote for if you're a good Democrat? Think on that. But also, they seem to gloat in defending such politics. Doublespeak in how you look. That person looked presidential. So what? Why do I care how they look? I don't care if they came out with a bag over their head. It's the quality of their mind. It's the ability to help the people. It's the ability to rebuild infrastructure. It's the ability to depoliticize the system of money and influence, to take all money out of all politics, to set term limits of one term in office, and that's it, to criminalize a lobbying by anyone. If a person's not bright enough to know what the issues are, they shouldn't be in a position of public responsibility to vote on these. And put everyone who commits a crime, a white-collar crime, to the same standards of punishment that you do people who commit nonviolent crimes. Let all nonviolent criminals out of jail. Put them back into the public sector doing community work. I'd rather see 2 million people helping clean up ghettos, helping to rebuild infrastructure, helping them help society than languish in prisons. It makes no sense. Decriminalize all drugs. You would stop all the profit from being in it, and hence think of all the gangs that are now killing, raping, murdering. They wouldn't have an incentive. You would be able to deconstruct whole agencies of government. That is the right thing to do. Have centers in every single community in the United States where people can get the kind of counseling and help and tutorial that they need, not to take a test, but a tutorial on how to survive in life. And that's what we're not offering. So if you don't offer that, and if a kid goes home and finds out that the parents cannot afford the rent and their house or their apartment can be taken away from them, and there's a gang member who says, well, we'll pay for your family's rent, and we'll get you food, and we'll see you have clothes, which direction do you think that youth might go? And then we wonder why. Just before the crash, we had only 400,000 members of gangs. Now we have closer to 2 million, and it's going to jump again. And those are the gangs of the poor. Why don't we ever discuss the gangs of the rich, who will not go on a street and do a smackdown on you while their friends stream this for some kind of sadistic joy? But what about the people who just went in and to Africa and privatized people's water or land to plant their genetically engineered seed? That's a smackdown that will cause starvation and death. But we're very particular in what we consider a morally repulsive crime versus one that is completely acceptable, even honorary. And that bothers me. We have low-intensity war being waged by a variety of corporate institutions through the educational force of a culture that commercializes every aspect of a kid's life. and now uses the internet and various social networks along with the new media technologies such as smartphones to immerse young people in the world of mass consumption in ways that are more direct and expansive than anything we've ever seen in the past. Commercially carpet bombed by an advertising industry that in the United States spent $189 billion in 1 year, the typical child is exposed to 40,000 ads a year. By the time they reach the fourth grade, the children can memorize 300 to 400 brands. An entire generation is being drawn into a world of consumerism in which commodities and brand loyalty become the most important markers of identity and the primary frameworks of mediating one's relationship with the world. Increasingly, many young people recast as commodities can only recognize themselves in terms preferred by the market. As the sociologist Bauman pointed out, youth are simultaneously promoters of commodities and the commodities they promote, defined as both brands and merchandise on the one hand and marketing agents on the other. What are the consequences of this? Public spaces have been transformed into neoliberal disimagination zones, which makes it more difficult for young people to find public spheres where they can locate themselves and translate metaphors of hope into meaningful action. The dreamscapes that make up a society built on the promises of mass consumption translate deftly into ad copy, insistently promoting and normalizing a neoliberal order in which economic relations now provide the master script for how young people define themselves and their relations with others in the larger world. Now, how in the world can you, as a parent who was not exposed to this, have primarily not used this, how can you compete with that? It is very difficult. The data mining marketers make young people think they can count when, in fact, all they want to do is count them. The dominant culture's overbearing ecology of consumption now works to selectively eliminate and reorder the possible modes of political, social, and ethical vocabularies made available to youth. Young people's most private experiences are now colonized by a consumerist ethic that deforms their sense of agency and desires and values and hopes. Trapped within a spectacle of marketing, their capacity to be critically engaged and societally responsible citizens is simply compromised. As a result, a young person today is more likely to take a photo of themselves eating some cereal in the morning and posting as if that is relevant to who they are. It is not, but that is how powerful that message of connecting them to a superficial world of vacant values is. The hard war is a more serious and dangerous development for young people, especially those who are marginalized by virtue of their ethnicity, race, gender, sexuality, and class. The hard war refers to the harshest elements of a growing youth crime control complex that operates through a logic of punishment, surveillance, and control. The young people targeted by this punitive measure are often poor youth of color who are considered failed consumers and must be feared, and who can only afford to live on the margins of a commercial culture that excludes anybody without money, resources, and leisure time. They are youth considered uneducatable and unemployable and therefore troublesome, if not a threat to the existing order. The imprint of the youth crime control complex can be traced back to the now normative practices of organizing life in schools through disciplinary practices that subject students to constant surveillance through high-tech security devices while imposing on them harsh and often thoughtless zero-tolerance policies that closely resemble measures used by the criminal legal system. In this instance, poor youth and class of color become objects of a new mode of governance based upon the crudest forms of disciplinary control. Punished if they don't show up at school and punished if they do attend school, many of these students are funneled into what has been ominously called the school-to-prison pipeline. If middle and upper-class kids are subject to the seductions and market-driven public relations, working-class youth are caught in the crosshairs between the arsenal of commercial desire and the harsh imposition of securitization, surveillance, and policing. How else do we explain the fact that the United States today, 500,000 young people are incarcerated, 2.5 million are arrested every year, and that by the age of 23, almost a third of the American population of young people are arrested for a crime? What kind of a society allows 1.6 million children to be homeless on any given day of the year, or allows a massive inequality in wealth and income to produce a politically and morally dysfunctional society in which 45% of residents live in households that struggle to make ends meet? Current statistics paint a bleak picture for young people in the richest country in the world. And that means that 18 million people, kids, go without food that they need on a daily basis. Why isn't that taken into consideration along with everything else that matters? It should be. It hasn't been. And until it is, we will still see ourselves looking in amazement at the kid that acts inappropriately or the kid that's trying to act appropriately, and we're not paying attention. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.